And also what's missing from my abstract, and let me put it right now, is that I'm going to talk about joint work with Michael Weinstein. So everything here is joint work with Michael Weinstein. And part of what I'm going to talk about is still under construction, basically. So here is the problem I'm going to talk about, is the linear Schrodinger equation with an attractive potential and with a time-dependent potential as a perturbation. So let me write that time-dependent potential in this form. And about the unperturbed problem, I'm going to suppose that it does have bound states, but which are outside the continuum spectrum, so basically the idea of attractive potential, and maybe short range, not to have embedded eigenvalues. So let's say we have lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, lambda 4, and even you can have hundreds of eigenvalues in this problem. So that's the spectrum for this operator, which basically means that in the absence of the nonlinear time-dependent perturbation, your solution looks simply as a quasi-periodic part plus A2 e to the minus I lambda 2t psi 2. And so that depends on how many bound states you have. Now psi 1 is the bound state, let me just write that, minus Laplacian plus V, sorry for that, psi E is simply lambda E, I guess, lambda E, psi E. So this is the elliptic problem which has solution because we are talking about an attractive potential. Depends on how many bound states you have to write them all. I'm just writing two of them. And of course, there is a remaining part, which is the projection of the solution onto the continuum spectrum. This part, as you see, the coefficients A1, A2 don't change in time. Phi D of T changes in time. And in fact, well, let's say it from the beginning. Phi D of T, I could use the L1, L infinity norm, which Michael was using a few minutes ago, but let me use another norm here, x to the power minus sigma. If you compute this in the standard L2 norm, so it's L2 norm with a localization, think of x to the power minus sigma like basically x, absolute value of x. X here is the space variable and can be any dimension you want as the absolute value of x to a power sigma, but you have to remove the singularity in zero. So that's why it is, well, probably exactly this thing to the power. That's basically the definition of x. So what happens with this part? This part goes like, now it depends on the dimension, doesn't it? So let me just say that goes like C1, a function of t, times the times the projection on the continuum spectrum initially, which you have to assume that it's quite localized in order to get this decay. So that's the L2 norm of the, you know, now you enhance phi d of 0 at infinity and you still want it in L2. That means the initial condition, the projection of the initial condition onto the bound state, onto the continuum spectrum should have been localized. And in that case, you get this behavior where C of t decays. Whatever I'm going, what I'm supposing basically is that C of t is in L1. Of time. So it's integrable. So in three dimension, usually C of t is 2 to the power minus 3 halves. So that works. That's integrable for all the time. You integrate from 0 to infinity. If you are in two dimension, I guess you are 1 over t log square t. That's still integrable. And if you are in one dimension, well, many of people say you have t to the minus 1 half. That's not quite true. There is a recent paper by Ricardo Vedder. Once you have a little bit of an attractive potential, the zero resonance you have for the Laplacian in one dimension disappears, and you have t to the power minus 3 half decay even in three dimension from the for the unperturbed problem, for the projection on the of the dispersive part of the unperturbed problem. So my assumption is not quite, you know, not just mathematical, it's just also, you can find it in practical examples. So that was without any perturbation. And now if you introduce the time-dependent perturbation, what you would like to describe is the dynamics, and one way to do it is to just say that you are looking at 1 of t psi 1 plus a 2 of t e to the minus I lambda 2 of t psi 2, and you expect that a 1 and a 2, because you have an epsilon in front of the perturbation, to vary slowly, maybe change on time scale of order 1 over epsilon, and change significantly. And of course, you will have again the phi d of t of x, about which you cannot say anything right now, because maybe the bound states will couple with the dispersive part and may enhance the energy of the dispersive part. And that's exactly what happens. The energy of the dispersive part grows, but it is dispersed to infinity. So if you look back in localized norms, you lose that energy, and you lose that energy from the bound states. And I'm going to talk about the decay of the bound states because of the of the time-dependent perturbation. That's the dynamical picture. The static spectral picture would be that time-dependent potential tend to shift the continuum spectrum. It will cover eigenvalues. If they are covered, they actually become poles and go down, and they are decaying. Now, but I'm trying to do that rigorously, and I'm going to do not a spectral picture, but a time evolution picture. And let me tell you the important part. Why do I talk about what kind of time-dependent perturbation I'm talking about? And let me just describe for you G of t. We have quite general results about... Let me describe G of t. I want to talk today basically about this picture. G of t looks like that. It's the same pulse repeated. And you have distances between the pulses. This is d naught. This is, well, distance is exactly from the onset of the pulse and from the finishing of the other of one pulse and the onset of the next pulse. Now, since they have a shape, maybe that's not the smartest way to graph this, but that's what I'm thinking about. And dot. And I'm, you know, we fully understand the case when case one, dn as a sequence, the sequence of distances between the pulses is periodic. I think soon enough we'll understand case two. Dn is, I guess I don't have to give a definition of periodicity, but Dn is almost periodic. Maybe I should give a definition on what means that a sequence is almost periodic. Instead of giving you a definition, I'm just going to give you an example, and that example is Dn is D d bigger than 1, well, why shouldn't I take it exactly equal to 1, okay? 1 plus cosinus 2 pi nu n, okay? Now, if nu is rational, it's a simple exercise to show that d of n is periodic, and you are in this case, but you miss that by a little bit. And nu is just not almost periodic, it's not just not in rational. And my point here is that because you have many bound states, and not because if you have one bound state, the problem is clear even in that case, in this case, but because you have many bound states, all hell breaks loose, and I want to describe you what breaks loose here and what's not going to work as expected from initial work by Avi Sofer and Michael Weinstein. Okay, so K3, which probably I won't be able to talk about, but K3 is dn. Is a sequence of identically and independent distributed, independent and identically distributed random variables. And I claim that we do understand that too. Now, the paper should be submitted soon. And what's important about here, well, if this is if g of t has randomness in it, you can treat this as a stochastic process. Limiting theorem, large time behavior, asymptotic for this type of system has been studied, but if you want to study the limit rigorously, you have to have no continuum spectrum in your problem. We added that. We understand it with the continuum spectrum. And I hope that will bring some light on what happens in other equations which have randomness in them and also radiation in them, and they were treated by stochastic method, which could not carry any rigorous analysis of what happens with the continuum spectrum. Okay, so that's the summary. And now let's do some technicalities. And I'm going to do the technicalities in the periodic case and show what goes wrong in the almost periodic case and how can you recover some of the results in the periodic case. Yes? Yeah. But you know, I don't have a problem with that really. Let me tell you something. Imagine that it would be much easier for me to treat the following case. Imagine that g of t is constructed this way. The first one, you have some defects which appear with a given frequency, so it's a periodic thing. Then you construct another one with another period, which is maybe non-commensurate with the first one. If it's commensurate, you'll get a periodic sequence. When you do that, you may do overlapping, but overlapping is addition. So I don't know if I know to add geometrically this too, but I believe that you will get, instead of this, you will get something like that. Believe me, that was true here, but it's a different frequency. Maybe this other guy appears exactly here, so it gives another thing. This won't look like a train of pulses right now, but let me get to the almost periodic case. The big difference between this with a wrong frequency, irrational frequency, and this with given frequencies and then added up the defects, basically, or the pulses, is that here you can have finitely many frequency in the spectrum of the resulting almost periodic function. This is the almost periodic function. While here the big problem will be the following. You have infinitely many frequencies in it, and they are dense everywhere in R. They are like Q. All the frequencies here are like Q, and that's what the what the hell is in this problem. And it won't be in this one. I'd be much happier with this one. And this one will be treated exactly as the periodic case by a paper which already has appeared in Communication in Mathematical Physics 2003, and the author is Michael Weinstein and myself. This will be treated exactly like it's we work there. This cannot. Oh, that's my problem here. So I said that I'm going to talk about case one, and case one is Dn is periodic. If Dn is periodic, G of t is periodic. If G of t is periodic, let me just jump and not compute what's the period, what's the main frequency. It should look exactly like sum of some Fourier coefficients times e to the I some frequencies. Now the frequencies are all commensurate with a given main frequency. So mu of n are in fact n mu for a given mu, let's say bigger than zero, n is in Z here. And one assumption, it's technical assumption, and actually we can probably get rid of it if you have examples in which you cannot check these, or, you know, significant examples, is that this sum is bounded by 1. Well, if it's not bounded by 1, you put it in epsilon, and if it's in epsilon, you still, my results will carry out for, or our results will carry out for epsilon small, so you have to be careful. So this, if this is large, then the coupling coefficient epsilon here has to be much and much smaller in order to all of these results to carry out. But aside of that, how can I get such kind of thing? Well, I haven't checked recently, but I guess if this is C1 plus something, this pulse here, I'm fine. If it is C2, I'm for sure fine to say that. If this is like very if it is discontinuous, unfortunately, I will have only this to be true. And if you really think that in practical problems you would like to work with that, I'm willing to extend the theory for such kind of condition, but right now let me just do it with this. Because we will have some, in the terms I'm going to compute for you, we will have some sums like that, and you will ask me, well, is that convergent? It is because of this assumption. So, okay. Now, the technique about Michael was talking is getting coupled equation between these amplitudes and the bound states and the continuum spectrum, and try to read what are the main contributions from the continuum spectrum in the bound states. So without doing anything else than a paper, Non-Autonomous Hamiltonian by Michael Weinstein and Avi Soffer, what you get is the following, that the derivative of the amplitudes, well, let me stop at 4, because I will have N, M's, Q's, and K's, and in too many things in my blackboard here. So let me stop it at 3. 3 bound states instead of 4 there. It's the following. This is one of the main contribution coming from the interaction with the radiation modes. Another contribution is, this is not from the radiation modes. This is basically coupling between the modes because of the frequencies in G of t. So this has nothing to do with radiation modes. Now, next term, let's denote it by lambda. This is also coming from, and it's epsilon squared, from the radiation interaction with the radiation modes, and the time-dependent part coming from the interaction with the radiation modes is, well, is an omega t, and with an epsilon squared in front, and that should apply to A1, A2, A3, and of course you should have correction to that, and the correction are time dependent, depend on the amplitudes A. Now capital A is this vector, okay? And it depends also on the projection on the continuum spectrum at time t. Actually, it depends on the projection on the continuum spectrum at all the times before the time you do the calculation. So it's a convolution operator. And that's about it. And the point is that you would like at least to say that this is order epsilon on timescales of 1 over epsilon squared. Why 1 over epsilon squared? Because that's where you can, in this linear problem, you are going to see exponential decay of the bound states due to this term. And maybe, and that's doable, you would like to say that this correction term even goes to 0. So f goes to 0 as p goes to infinity, which will basically say, now if you are able to analyze this part, and supposedly we can do that, and that's what I'm going to talk a bit, that will say that eventually all the energy in the bound states, because of this exponential decay coming in the bound states, will go out. So there will be nothing in the bound states because of that, and nothing in the bound states because of the correction goes to 0 also. So it's full ionization, if you want. Well, I'm going to give you the flavor of what how the terms in that look like. Okay? So I will just write it right now. Now, the most important gamma has component ij. It's a matrix, of course. And let me just write what that is. It's sum over n, gn, gm bar. These are the coefficients in the Fourier series of g. They are, you perturb psi I by the space dependence of the poles, and you perturb psi j by the same thing, dependence of the perturbation on the space, and you project everything. Let me show you on what. H0 minus lambda I, let me put it like that, minus mu n. So that's the mu n coming from gn. Okay, let me just explain this formula, and this will hold for mu n plus lambda I equal mu m plus lambda j. You don't sum over everything only for on this type of chart. Let me just show the picture, and that will explain everything. Let's look at gamma 1, 1, the first term, the coupling of A1 with A1 through this matrix. That will be the following. This is your mu n, say, in this formula. Psi j is now psi 1, psi I is now psi 1. And what you have here is lambda 1 plus mu n lands here. Let's call this omega. What you have, what this guy says, is that you take the projection of this bound state of beta psi 1 onto the generalized eigenmode living here in the continuum spectrum. That's what it says. Now, how about the off-diagonal terms? And these are terms which, you know, don't come from, this is Fermi golden rule, basically. But you may have off-diagonal terms in the Fermi golden rule, and they may affect you pretty much, in fact, is when there is another frequency, mu m, which makes lambda 2 to go to the same, to be coupled to the same generalized eigenmode in the continuum spectrum. That will bring out this term. So when they are equal, you have an off-diagonal term in gamma, at the position 1, 2 in this case, and of course 1 at the 2, 1, so this will be a symmetric matrix, and that's the way you compute it, that tau, basically. It's still a kind of a projection of beta psi 1 and beta psi 2 onto this eigenvalue. It's actually, this is a matrix with, it's a self-adjoint matrix, and all the eigenvalues are non-negative. Non-negative, there is a negative sign in front. So you can show these things. Now, you would like, and in this case, look, in this case, well, I didn't say it, this is an infinite sum here. And the reason it's an infinite sum and not a finite sum of frequency is because I have so many zeros in my problem, which, by the way, won't happen here because of the way they couple, they may, you know, you may kill all the zeros. Because I have so many zeros in this problem, I need to have here infinitely many terms, and that means here I'm summing over all these little coupling I just described. You have to sum over all. And you can sum over all because this is true. You could even sum if there is no off-diagonal terms. You can even sum if only this was true because Gn becomes Gm then. And this is the square. C1 plus something. But again, if you believe that if you deform a fiber or if you send a pulse to an atom, a pulse like that, that pulse is like 0, 1, then I'm willing to do the extension. But if you believe that you cannot send 0, 1 pulses, just a smoothed pulse between 0 and n, maybe rapidly changing from 0 to 1, I'm saying here, then I'm fine to begin with. So, okay, this is the most important part, and now the ones which will cause the break in the almost periodic case are eta of t is of the form e to the minus I lambda I plus eta, okay, ij. So this has components also. Ij run between 1 and 3. It will be lambda I minus lambda j plus 1 of the frequencies. You sum over all this frequency and you have also some coefficient. The beta is not here. There is a beta psi j here. And you sum, what do you have here? Gn in front. And you sum over all these things. This is the correction coming from interaction between bound states and bound states. Michael showed that picture. When that becomes zero, this is time t, when that becomes zero, you say that you have a resonance between bound states, something like that. So that will be a constant coefficient here if that becomes zero, but generally it won't become zero, so you have time-dependent coefficients there. Now, these guys, well, I could have written this like imaginary part of H0 minus lambda I minus mu n to the power minus 1. That's what it breaks down to. To analyze how the waves interact with the bound states, you have to use the resolvent in these resonance places. Now, omega is just the real part of this. This is the imaginary part, gamma. The real part is capital lambda. And it's again self-adjoint. It has an I in front, so it's Q-symmetric now. Okay? So it won't really contribute to any energy estimates. Now this is the problem again. Omega ij are sum n gn summed over n nm gn gm complex conjugate e to the minus I minus lambda j plus mu n minus mu m t, and similar terms with, maybe I don't remember what the terms here are exactly. But they are bounded. They are bounded. I'm interested in the frequencies, though. It's a bit more complicated than the simple terms you have here. But I guess I just give it a shot. And I guess, yeah, it's not a shot, it's the real thing. It's H0 minus one of them, lambda I, minus mu n to the power minus one. Well, if you have, you land on the continuous spectrum, you have to regularize that, beta psi j, and this is projection on PC on the continuum spectrum. Very important. All of these are projection on the continuum spectrum. So these are coming really from the interaction with the continuum spectrum. So that's all what this is. And basically, let me just tell what's the secret here. Here, this is never zero, because whenever this is zero, I put it in gamma or in capital lambda. So it's just a decomposition of this term coming from the interaction with the continuum spectrum in that time-independent part and time-dependent part. And if you were, that's never zero. If you were in a one-dimensional case, that means only one bound state, you are done. Because we all know how to solve a linear problem with time-dependent coefficients, though, but one linear equation, first order, with time-dependent coefficients. Once you have a system, that's not that simple. And this paper, what does, is try to remove the time-dependent terms into the correction term. And this is a series of normal form transforms. So you do a kind of a normal form computation, and in order to make that work, or if you want, let's say it, you want to average out the oscillations in this part, okay? In order for that to work, well, let me be blind to understand fully the dynamics. Well, in order for that to work in the first place, you have to have lambda I minus lambda j plus mu n minus mu m in absolute value bigger than something. So when it's zero, I don't care about. I'm talking about these terms here. When it's zero, it's already in gamma and eta and capital lambda, and we always can understand constant coefficient linear equations. So I don't care about those. But when they are not zero, they better be should be away from delta and away from zero, and in a manner like this. Otherwise, yeah.
So, to be clear that omega minus gamma is negative definite on average or something like that, so you have decay?
Omega and minus gamma, well, that's the problem. It's not clear. It's not clear. No. It's not. They are of the same order. These are like oscillating cosiners. You can get negative numbers. A positive, well.
Right, the thing is, you'd like to think of the gamma as like the.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, okay.
The omega is like an oscillatory zero mean correction.
Correct.
But is that clear, or?
Okay, but it's an oscillatory and a nicely oscillatory zero mean correction if that happens. If that doesn't happen, so if you have frequencies in that going towards zero, they may, on long term, they may have a very strong effect. If you integrate an almost periodic function with frequency which goes to zero, you can get an unbounded function, even though it was mean zero. That's the big problem. So put it this way, for the ODE guys, if you can analyze this problem with slowly vary coefficients, I mean, let them go to zero, basically, this thing, or make them much more smaller than the epsilon which appears in that problem. If you can tell me how to do that, I can tell you how to then prove this is not coming from for free. Only if you understand the dynamics of this, you can prove that a correction, because this is like an implicit correction. Only if this gives you decay in A1, A2, then this is bounded by epsilon on 1 over epsilon times squared. And if you are working hard, you can make it go to zero if A of t goes to zero. So that's the deal here, basically. So now, but I'm in the periodic case. This is n mu minus m mu. And, you know, my baking epsilon sufficiently small, this will be always true. So this works. So, you know, this is a lattice, basically. So these are mu's, 2 mu, 3 mu, 4 mu, 4 mu. And now you put lambda I minus lambda j. You can place it on one of them, or you can place it at a certain distance over them. These are finite numbers. They are lambda I minus lambda j are 6 numbers. Place 6 numbers here. Some of them, place them on top if you want. I don't care. They will be in gamma and in capital lambda. Some of them, place them. Here are they, lambda I minus lambda j. 6 numbers. I take the distance between 6 numbers and this lattice. I'm going to have a delta. And now I make epsilon squared much less than delta. And I'm done. And the reason I'm only needing that is that that I only need the self-adjoint part of this matrix, which is hard to compute, but it's nice after you compute it, to be moved to the continuum, to the correction term. Then this globally has an energy decay if gamma is positive definite, and that's enough to close the estimates on the correction terms. One second, if you fully want to understand the dynamics, you would like to move also this out. So to have no time dependence, and the extra condition will be, and that's tough, that's much tougher to move the resonances between the near resonances between the eigenstates. Whenever this is zero, that's fine, you keep it in the main dynamics. Whenever it's not zero, better be bigger than a delta, which is much bigger now than epsilon, not epsilon squared. You have to do it twice to move it out. Oh, that's basically the picture. Yeah, there were some questions. Which term? Mu n? Lambda I minus lambda j plus mu n? That's here. Eta ij, which in this one. In the self, in the skew symmetric part. They will be moved in the correction terms. Yeah, they won't. No, initially you don't have those terms. Initially you do not. It's a second order perturbation theory, basically, with complete understanding of the correction term. Basically, it's a second order. You don't. When you move it with the normal form transforms, they appear here, but the advantage is that they appear, you know, they do appear, but they don't appear as denominators. What I'm saying here is that the denominators, when you make the normal form transforms, will be like this, and they don't have to blow up. So, for example, in this one, you will have denominators like epsilon squared over delta. You move them here. That's the normal transform. Better that be small. That's what I'm saying here. Otherwise, you cannot close anything or any estimate. You cannot do rigorous analysis. I guess I have only 5 minutes left, so there was a question? Okay, there were 5 minutes left. So we are fine with the periodic things just because these work, since we are on an equally distant lattice, and you place here lambda I minus lambda j, which are six. Six numbers, how many they are? It's 3 choose 2. So you do the computations. Yeah, so a finite number of lambda is minus lambda j. Case 2. And case 2 is simply dn equal 1 plus cosinus 2 pi nu n nu irrational. That simply means that g of t can also be written as exactly the same form. The big difference is that now mu n don't satisfy something like that. And let me tell you what mu n is. Mu n are the following numbers. Take any two integers, k and l, multiply the first one by 2 pi over d plus t, multiply the second one by 2 pi nu over d plus t, add them up. That's for all k and l. Maybe it will be simple for all of us to look at d plus t over 2 pi times mu n, the frequency in the problem. That will be a k plus l nu. K and l are arbitrary integer numbers. This is dense on the real line. So when you plot the frequency, so what I had before is g of t. G of t has the following spectrum, the periodic case. G of t had the following spectrum, a given frequency mu, then 2 mu, 3 mu, and minus mu, and minus 2 mu, and so on. It's a nice lattice with nice spacing between. Look at these guys. These guys are... I don't even know how to represent it. Try to put here the entire rational numbers on the real axis. That's what you get. So that's the big problem, and then where the big problem occurs, the analysis is exactly the same if you want, but what do you do with that? They are dense in R. These are also... mu n minus mu m will be dense in R. These are a few numbers on R, but you can get densities there. The trick will be, and we are working on that, I still want to move only the self-adjoint part here. I will have a contribution from the... When the frequencies get very close, so this gets very close to zero, and you look at the self-adjoint part, you will have a difference between the resolvents, which will give you an extra coefficient. The difference between the resolvent will be small. And combine that's if you compute the self-adjoint part of that, and combine that with the fact that when you want this mu n minus mu m to converge to a certain lambda I minus lambda j, you have to use very large k and l's, and that will mean very small coefficients. And I do have them here. So those small coefficients hopefully will help us kill the contribution of the slowly varying part in this matrix for the almost periodic case. And that's work in progress, basically. And the reason I want to understand that is that if you plot this sequence, you will have nowhere to tell that that's not a random sequence. Okay? And it's not a random, it's not. And I guess even when you create your random sequences on the computer, you use almost periodic sequences, in fact, badly looking. Now, we do understand what happens if from the beginning this would have been random. Now, are they similarities? Do bad almost periodic sequence give a look in this problem to the result? The result will look like, how will it look like almost like periodic or like random? And between periodic and random, we know that there is a big difference, and Michael has already said. In the periodic case, what you have is some energy exchange between the bound states and a decay of the bound states due to this term. I already removed this. I told you approximately how. What happens in the random case, there is no energy exchange between the bound states. The energy is just spread uniformly to all the bound states on long time. So you expect to see the energy equally distributed in all the bound states. You expect that. Of course, there is variance around the expected value, and that appears to be large, but... Let's say that you expect to see the energy equally distributed between bound states. You don't see that in periodic case. So where does almost periodicity switch from looking like periodic to random? And probably this is a good toy example if you want to consider this a toy to maybe understand that, and I'm going to stop here.